Let's open our Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 3, verse 22, and finish the story of how God saved the three kings of Judah, Israel, and Moab from dying of thirst on their attempt to invade the country of Moab. You remember how it all started? The Moabites had abandoned their tributary status to northern Israel right after the death of King Ahab. Here we are a little over a year and a half later, maybe almost 2 years later, and the new king of northern Israel, Jehoram, has convinced Jehoshaphat, the king of southern Judah, to join him in a punishing campaign against the rebel Moabites. And Jehoshaphat has brought along the king of Edom, who is tributary to the southern kingdom of Judah during this time. But when these three kings pushed around the southern end of the Dead Sea and then got ready to shove themselves into the southern borderland of Moab, it was so dry, so barren, so desolate, they were totally out of water and they were in trouble. And so they go to the prophet Elijah, who apparently had tagged along behind the Israeli army, and they ask for God's assistance. And even though Elisha has harsh words for the king of northern Israel, out of respect for the righteous king of southern Judah, he says, God will provide. There won't be rainstorms or anything like that, but you will have more than enough water tomorrow. And they did. Now, the Moabites have gotten word, no doubt they have spies, that they've got this three-king army approaching them from the south. And so they muster up as many people as they can. They don't have as big an army as they used to have because a bunch of them were lost the previously in this year when they tried to invade Judah. But what they do have, they get together to take on the three kings. So verse 22 of 2 Kings 3 says, when these guys, these Moabites, rose early in the morning, the sun shone on the water. That is the water that had been provided for the three kings' armies. And because it's the early morning sun, which is rising through the dry air to the east, it is very red in color, and it makes the water on the surface of the ground look red. So the Moabites saw the water opposite them as red as blood, and they jumped to a conclusion. I mean, after all, it hadn't rained last night. Why would they think there was any water down there? They knew it was very dry. And so they said, this is blood. The kings have surely fought together. They've struck one another down, which is ironic because that is exactly what happened to the Moabite, Ammonite, and Mount Seir, Muonite, group that had tried to invade Judah earlier. They had ended up fighting with each other and killing each other. So the Moabites assume everybody's dead in the invading army. And so they said, Moab, to the spoil! Let's go get the goodies! When they came to the camp of Israel, which must have been a big surprise to the Israelis, they were probably like enjoying the water and getting their water tanks all filled up, their canteens and barrels and things like that. And maybe they were talking strategy, you know, what do we do next in order to take on these Moabites now that we have supplies of water? But then suddenly, a whole bunch of Moabites just come rushing into their their tent area, into their camp area. And so when they came into the camp of Israel, the Israelis, well, they rose up and they struck the Moabites. So they turn around and it's like, what, what? And so they start attacking the Moabites. And no doubt the Moabites, shocked at seeing all these people alive with water, they run away. And so they fled before them. And so they went forward, striking the Moabites as they went. So the three-king army, made up of Israelis and the Judean kingdom people and then the Edomite people, they chased these guys down. And this is the beginning of the punishment campaign that Elisha told them God wanted them to do. The Moabites had crossed a line and had come under God's judgment. And so the destruction of some of the Moabites earlier in the year, that was part of that judgment. And now comes the next part of it. And so verse 25 talks about a campaign that takes some time. They overthrew the cities, which means they would have pulled down large places of the walls. And on every good piece of land, every man threw a stone until it was covered. So they break down the walls around the different fields. When a person worked on a field, they typically went through and they picked up all the stones and made their barrier walls and things with that. So apparently now the armies of Israel are going in there and just breaking those walls down and tossing those stones back into the field. Now, what's the purpose of this? It will keep the Moabites busy for quite some time getting their agricultural land back into proper shape so that they're not in trouble food-wise. So they break down the city walls and they put the fields out of business for a bit of time. They stopped every spring of water. So they're stopping water sources, which this is a fairly arid area where Moab is located, east of the Dead Sea. And so if you start throwing a whole bunch of big rocks and things into those open areas, it's going to take time to clear all of that out in order to get your water supply open again. And they also felled every good trees, all the good trees, which this is an exception to the Mosaic Law's rules of warfare. It would appear to be. And that is, when you went into an area, you did not destroy the food-producing trees because you would want them for yourself. Well, in this case, they do destroy an awful lot of those trees, again, to force the Moabites to spend more time recovering and a whole lot less time causing trouble. This is a punishment campaign. It is a judgment campaign by God. And then all of this happened until only its stones were left in Kir Hareshet. So this is one of their main cities. That's the only one that is left intact. And so then the slingers surrounded and attacked it. So this is probably several weeks later, perhaps even a couple of months. After they've done all this to the other cities, they're all surrounding this great big main town. And when the king of Moab saw that the battle was going against him, so he realizes this is going to end up with us done. He tried one last desperate sally. He took with him 700 swordsmen to break through opposite the king of Edom. So he tries to force through with 700 swordsmen through the battle lines to get to the king of Edom, his southern neighbor. probably to kill him, because the idea would be, I will take out at least this guy and I'll make them pay for what they've done to me. But we're told they could not get that done. So he does something that is so horrendous. It causes the Israelis to stop their campaign. Then he took his oldest son, who was to reign in his place, and he offered him for a burnt offering on the wall. Now remember that the Moabites and their brother group, the Ammonites, are descendants of Lot through incest with his daughters after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And over time, they developed a twisted religion where they worshiped a god that they either called Molech, which means king, or Chemosh, which means destroyer. So put them together, the destroyer king. So they worshiped this destroyer king god by getting drunk and having sexual relationships with the purpose of getting pregnant. It seems as if they did this annually. I think it was likely on the anniversary of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, but can't find any clear historical evidence to that. But during this ceremony, they would take the babies born from the last ceremony and use them as human sacrifices. They would burn them up, offer them to Chemosh Molech, the destroyer king. They'd burn them up in the fire. This is called passing through the fire. It's one of the atrocious things carried on, not just by the Moabites and the Ammonites, but it spread to other groups around here, and God hated it and talked about it to the Israelis. And in fact, the Israelis eventually started practicing it themselves, and it's listed as one of the reasons God had had enough of them. So my whole point in that is this king of Moab has no doubt burned up a few of his own kids before, but they were little bitty babies that were specifically brought into existence for that purpose. But he is in such dire straits at this point, he feels that Chemosh Molech needs the ultimate sacrifice from him. So he takes his heir and burns him up right there in front of everybody. And then the rest of the verse says, and there came great wrath against Israel, and they withdrew from him and returned to their own land. So when Jehoram, the king of northern Israel, saw that happen right there in front of him, up there on the wall, apparently it ended his desire to continue this any longer. Perhaps he figured that, you know, he's killed his own heir. That's horrible. That's a horrendous thing to do. Let's just leave. And maybe Jehoshaphat was just as repulsed by it as well. And so the campaign is now over, and Moab is definitely very, very broken at this point in our story. 2 Kings chapter 4 now talks about several of the events in the life of Elisha the prophet. We don't have any clear-cut dates for any of these things. It happens during the reign of Jehoram, the king of Israel, and we know that he reigns on for quite a few years, I think 20-some, if I'm not mistaken. Let me double-check myself here. Well, no, I can't find it that quick. Anyway, he goes long enough that all of these stories could happen during his reign. So, chapter 4 of 2 Kings, verse 1. Now, the wife of one of the sons of the prophets, so one of the students at one of these towns, cried to Elisha, so the guy who's in charge of the schools of the prophets, the sons of the prophets, "Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared he who is." So she speaks to Elisha and says, "You know my husband, you know what a good man he was. Well, he is dead now, and we've got a big problem." But the creditor, the guy that we owe money to, has come to take my two children to be his slaves. Now, we've talked about this idea that slavery in the ancient world was mostly because of indebtedness. If you took on a debt and you couldn't pay it off, then chances are you would end up being made a person's slave until you could pay the debt with your own physical labor. And once you entered into that slave contract of indebtedness, it could be sold to somebody else. Somebody else could pay the debt to the person that it was owed to, and then you would end up being the slave of the other person. If you owed a big enough debt, then not just you, but your family members could be turned into slaves. And so that's what this widow woman is concerned about, is that my husband owed money, and now he's dead. We don't have the wherewithal to pay this off. So the guy that has the debt contract is coming to take my two kids and sell them on the slave market to satisfy that debt. So Elisha said back to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?" So this is him verbalizing what needs to be done. And no doubt God's spirit is speaking to him in the midst of this moment. So tell me, what do you have at the house that actually belongs to you? She said, "Your servant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil. That's it. That's all the supplies we have, is one jar of olive oil." And then he said, "Go outside, borrow vessels from all your neighbors, empty vessels, and not too few." He says, so go to all your neighbors and ask to borrow every empty container they have. So all the jars, all the bowls, whatever will hold liquid, you borrow it. And so then do this. Go inside, shut the door behind yourself and your sons, and then pour into all these vessels. And when one is full, set it aside. So basically, you've got that one jar of olive oil, right? Well, get all these empty containers you can in your entire neighborhood. Bring it into your house, shut the doors, and then you just start pouring that oil into empty containers. Now, she should understand that there is a miracle coming, because just moving oil from one container to another, that's not going to fix the problem. Plus, why would you want all these other containers? So she knows that this is going to be miraculous, and she acts in faith upon this. So when she went from him and shut the doors behind herself and her sons, she poured and they brought the vessels to her. So you can picture this. She's got a couple of boys, minor young men, and they're like bringing great big jugs and jars and pots, and they're bringing them, and she's just standing there holding that jar of oil and just keeps pouring. Glug, 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 glug. It just keeps coming out. Just keeps streaming out. Tons more than it could have possibly been there. It is as miraculous as the unending container of flour and the unending jar of oil that Elijah had done for the widow. And so it just keeps going on until, verse 6, when the vessels were full, And you have to picture, the house has got to be full of these things, and they're all full of olive oil now. When the vessels were full, she said to herself, bring me another vessel. You know, get another empty one underneath here. And he said to her, there is not another. That's it. You're pouring into the last empty one we had. And when he said that, there's not another, then the oil stopped flowing. So the oil stopped. And then she came and she told the man of God. So she comes back to Elisha and says, hey, we filled up, I don't know how many vessels full of this olive oil from that one little jar. What do we do now? And he said, go, sell the oil. See, it's worth money. People use oil all the time. And so it is a valuable commodity. And so go and sell all of the oil that you've got in those containers and then pay your debts. And then you and your sons can live on the rest. Now imagine that. That's got to be a lot of oil. And they sell it so that they have enough to live off of from here on out. So a miraculous provision on this day by the prophet Elisha. Next story. One day, Elisha went on to Shunem. Now, this seems to be the Shunem we talked about earlier that is north of Jezreel. It is south and east from Nazareth, within a handful of miles of Nazareth, and only a couple of miles, I think, from the walls of Jezreel. And Elisha goes here where there's a wealthy woman living. He's passing through, and she urged him to eat some food. So she's being very hospitable. And apparently, it becomes clear to her that he will be passing by here on a regular basis. Remember, he's apparently going around visiting different little schools of the prophets all over northern Israel. So whenever he passed that way, he would turn in there to eat food. And so eventually she said to her husband, behold now, I know that this is a holy man of God who is continually passing our way. So this is the great prophet of northern Israel. He's constantly stopping by for a meal. Let's do this. Let's make a small room up on the roof with walls and put there for him a bed, a table, a chair, and a lamp so that whenever he comes to us, he can go in there. So let's make a little room up on the top for him to utilize on a regular basis. This is kind of the beginning of the idea of a prophet's room. Some people used to keep rooms at their house specifically for traveling preachers. And so that's what they did. Now, one day when he came there, he turned into the chamber and he rested there. And then he said to Gehazi, his servant, call this Shunammite. So he's sitting in his room up on the roof. And he says, go get the lady and bring her up here. When he had called her, she stood before him. The before him, I think, is before Gehazi, the servant. So she's outside on the roof. They use their flat roofs like decks. And Gehazi is probably standing in the doorway, and he is speaking back and forth between the two of them. Now, why Elisha is doing this, I don't know. But he's using Gehazi much like Moses would have used Aaron. You remember that back when we were studying the story of the Exodus. And so there's not an awful lot of direct talk between Elisha and this lady. So he said to him, say now to her, see, you've taken all this trouble for us. What is to be done for you? Would you have a word spoken on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army? Apparently, Elisha is respected by Jehoram, the current king of northern Israel. So he can offer, I could fix things up for the king with you. So she answered, I dwell among my own people, meaning I have what I need. And then he said, this is Elisha saying to Gehazi, well, what then is to be done for her? Now, Gehazi answered, well, she has no son. Her husband's old. So they're talking about this, and Gehazi kind of suggests, well, the one thing she seems to be missing is a child, and she's got an old husband. She's apparently a younger lady. So he said, call her. And when he had called her, she stood in the doorway this time. And he said, so here's directly to her. At this season, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. It sounds very much like the story of Abraham and Sarah, doesn't it? Where the angel, actually God and the two angels, say, this time next year, you're going to have a baby boy through Sarah. So this time next year, you're going to have a baby boy. She said back, oh, no, my Lord, oh, man of God, don't lie to your servant. So don't be messing with me. Don't play with me like that. But the woman did conceive. Within the next 3 months, she conceived. And then she bore a son about that time, the following spring, as Elisha had said to her. Now, some time passes, and we'll set this story up for next time because the clock is ticking away on us. When the child had grown, now how old is he? We don't know for sure. Probably preschool age or so. Maybe kindergarten, early elementary. That's the impression I get from the story. When the child had grown, he went out one day to his father among the reapers. So it's harvest season, and that means summertime. So he's out there in the summer sun, and suddenly he said to his father, oh, my head, my head. Now, did he have a sunstroke, or did he have an aneurysm? Doesn't matter. The story is miraculous because he is brought back to life by the prophet.